come. Alexandra Fuller's sequel to Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight, charting her eccentric childhood in southern Africa. Today, after Alexandra and Charlie's ordinary and sane life in America turns out to be just as chaotic and dangerous as their life in Africa, they decide to part. But on a weekend horse ride together, everything changes.
A month later, in less time than it takes to read these words, everything changed forever. That's what they say, of course. In the blink of the eye, in a single heartbeat, in one distracted moment, all the life we've got mapped out, however messy and uncertain, becomes certainly uncertain. For months after the accident, this was the image that came to me when I closed my eyes for any length of time. The last of Charlie's polo ponies, Big Boy, was upside down. His legs battered the air. His great black hooves sliced first the sky, then the sagebrush. His neck lunged sideways, and I could see his eyes rolling white. Underneath the horse, still improbably in the saddle, I could see Charlie. Mostly I could see his agonized face, his straining neck. The rest of his body was covered and in the process of being crushed. Charlie was going to die. Of that, I was certain. The seconds swelled and grew and burst. Fat drops of very distinct time. Big Boy made an effort to right himself. At last found purchase, his hooves connecting with the ground. Slowly he heaved himself up. Then he stood next to Charlie's body, head hanging, flanks pumping, legs quivering. I thought, it's not supposed to happen this way. This was supposed to be our calm, reasoned way out of the marriage. We were supposed to be out for a quiet Saturday afternoon ride to discuss how we could end our stalemate. Easy there, I told Big Boy, taking his reins and moving him away from Charlie. I crouched down. Charlie was still alive, but he was lying motionless, his face grey, his eyes open but unfocused. Hang on, I told him. Please, hang on. Then I spun down the trail we had just ridden up, back towards some mountain bikers we had seen earlier, and I was shouting as loudly as I could, tearing down the road towards help, that single word pouring out of my mouth. The two men and the woman in their mud-spattered lycra remained fixed in place against the tailgate of their car, a still life of bemusement. I managed to say what it was I needed to say. Someone had the sense to dial 911. By the time we got to the hospital, news of the accident had sizzled up and down lines of communication, and friends were waiting for us in the emergency room. The doctor arrived. We needed a life flight to get to a level 2 trauma hospital fast. At the Idaho Falls Hospital, Charlie had an X-ray, an MRI, a CT scan. He was taken into surgery. At last, the surgeon came down. He told me Charlie's lungs, liver and stomach were uninjured. He had removed his spleen, but this was cowboy country, and plenty of people burst their spleens one way or another and got along just fine without one. You can have your husband back home by Wednesday. Then I was shown up to a room where Charlie lay groggily in a bed. There were beeping monitors, the breathing sound of the blood pressure cuff, the occasional alarmed bird chirp of the morphine IV kicking in. There you are.
I think so, Charlie said.
Dismounting without permission. There was a chair next to the bed. I sat on it and took Charlie's hand, stroking the chapped knuckles, the bitten nails, the tennis racket calluses. Just before dawn, Charlie's breathing finally settled, and I could tell he was asleep. Eventually, I pulled the blinds and watched the sun break over town. Incredibly, by late afternoon, Charlie was ready to try walking. We found a window and looked out at the city, at the snow-peaked Centennial Mountains. Early the next morning, I did an interview with a journalist for my new book. While we were talking, a call came through. It was Charlie. He said he felt confused.
I can't get my brain is... Can you come?
I hurried to the hospital. Charlie looked baffled and fretful.
I'm mixed up.
I called for the doctor and he administered tests. He asked him to repeat certain phrases, but by then Charlie managed only exhausted preemptive moans. What's happening? The doctor was calm.
He's on some pretty strong medication, that's all.
I felt as if I alone were watching an accident unfold in slow motion. Charlie falling silently off a cliff. By early afternoon, there was no denying the severity of Charlie's condition. Charlie, as we had known him, was dying. At 3 o'clock, the neurologist confirmed that Charlie had suffered a shower of strokes for no reason that he could tell. 5 hours later, the threads that were holding Charlie to his life were snapping fast. He had lost words and the use of his limbs. He was unable to hold his lips firmly against his teeth. His eyelids were sagging. The doctors and nurses began to speak of him in the third person, and I could tell it wouldn't be too much of a jump for them to begin referring to him in the past tense. I insisted we move Charlie to Salt Lake City, to a place with a neurological intensive care unit.
It's very risky to move him, the doctor said.
It's very risky to keep him here, I replied. Then everything started to move quickly, time taking on a shocked, jumping quality. I signed papers authorizing Charlie's transfer. He was breathing, but beyond that he had stopped existing. Our airplane took off from Idaho Falls at midnight. In the dark, I wrapped my hand around Charlie's left foot. I love you. I'm sorry. Forgive me, I thought, over and over. Charlie and I had let the sun set on our anger too many nights, too many months, too many years in a row. We'd been so careless, so heartless, always assuming there would be another day, another chance. As soon as the ambulance deposited us at the hospital in Salt Lake City, Charlie was taken away for scans and tests. Meanwhile, a brain surgeon put the images I had brought on a screen. He pointed to two dark places where Charlie's neck connected to his head.
These are bilateral dissected carotid arteries, he said. There's not enough blood getting to his brain.
My parents were beyond reach in some little hotel near the Sacré-Cœur on their last tango to Paris. When Dad answered the phone, I started to cry. I told him everything. The ambulances and helicopter, the airplane ride, the strokes. There was a pause. Then Dad said,
"That's a lot of roaring about."
And I could see him weighing up the cost of all that fuel against the odds of Charlie's ultimate survival. And I was suddenly furious with the people who had raised me. Their crazy courage no longer seemed charming and life-affirming, and more or less innocent. It felt deliberately distancing and brutal.
"I can't do this alone," I said.
Dad was saying, "It doesn't sound like I can get there in time, Bobo. Please, Dad."
"What can an old Madala do that you can't?"
"I'm so frightened," I said. There was a long pause, and then Dad said, "You already know everything there is to know, Bobo. You've been here before." I hung up and hugged my knees, and the ways in which loneliness surrounded me became its own weather system. Dad never apologized for not being there, but months afterwards he said to me, "Sometimes you can give a person just enough help to sink them. Letting other people row their own boat to shore, well, that's the tricky bit." About an hour passed. At last, Charlie was brought back to the room. The nurse said, "Does your husband have a living will?" And then I noticed that the pupil in one of Charlie's eyes had frozen into a wide black dilation. The surgeon returned and said there was nothing more they could do for Charlie in this hospital.
"Then we'll move him to a hospital that can," I said.
The doctor shrugged.
At first light, Charlie was wheeled out to a tiny translucent-bellied helicopter. "Hang in there," I told him. "Please, hang in there." I spent the hours of Charlie's surgery alone in the waiting room of the neurological ICU at the University of Utah Hospital, bargaining with every power I could summon. Let him be able to feed himself. Let him be able to bathe alone. Let him be able to speak, I prayed. At noon, a team of surgeons came to tell me that the procedure had gone miraculously well. They had inserted a stent in Charlie's right carotid artery. Blood was flowing to the brain. A little over 2 hours after being wheeled up from surgery, Charlie opened his eyes and asked in a clear, lucid voice for water. Life doesn't stop just because life as we know it has ended. Charlie spent 4 weeks in hospital. When he came home, he slept a lot. His pain ebbed and flowed. The house would still have to go. We would have to work on the end of our marriage. "But we can stay together until you're better," I said. "I can be here for you." He said, "Will you work on the relationship then?" I knew what that meant. It meant Charlie wanted me to work on myself, to journey away from the bits of me of which he disapproved, and to arrive at a place he liked and understood, and to stay there as that fixed and dependable person. "No," I said. Charlie's face clouded. "Then we're done." Weeks passed. Charlie started to take walks along the river. He put on weight and his appetite returned. We undid our lives. Long after the divorce was final, feeling immovably weighted with grief, I experienced his removal like the earth itself had been taken from under my feet. You can be the perpetrator of your own emptiness. It can be the very thing you need, and it can still undo you. A long time ago, in Malawi, Dad bought a mirror dinghy and rigged it up on the lake. He showed me the basics. "Bottom is wet, top is dry," he said. "If that changes, you've capsized." He gave me a shove, and I was off skimming across the top of the water, the sound of the sails clacking in the wind. Things went well until I accidentally went about and the boom swung round and smacked me in the mouth. But even after that, with my fat lip and gappy smile, the taste of freedom had felt worth it. I learned this then. Sometimes the wind lulled and there was nothing to do, but wait it out in the tiny patch of shade afforded by the sail. And sometimes the wind got gusty and unpredictable, and then whatever line I pulled, things didn't make sense, and the boat seemed to get a mind of her own. But there was a feeling of emancipation too, the way I had sometimes felt on a horse, as if nothing malevolent could touch me, as if, for once, I wasn't my gender or my powerlessness, as if, for those hours, I was enough.
Tracy Ann Oberman was reading Leaving Before the Rains Come by Alexandra Fuller. It was abridged by Richard Hamilton and the producer was Justine Willett. Our next book of the week, starting on Monday, is by Mary Portas. And she's been making headlines this week after announcing that her brother is the sperm donor for the child she has with her wife. This morning's Woman's Hour will be talking about that after the news here on Radio 4. First, let's look ahead to tomorrow on 4 Extra.
Hello, I'm Lynn Truss, and I've picked my favourite programmes from the BBC Radio Archive. It was very hard to choose.
Where's the corkscrew?
Wouldn't you like a cup of tea first?
Fine, hot tea. Where is your heroic brother?
He's gone over to Batter Kettle Scab to fetch some embrocation.
Reckless youth.
I should warn you, it's all very gentle. Do you think you can cope with that? If so, join me for Lynn Truss' Pick of the Archive tomorrow morning at 9 and again in the evening at 7 on BBC Radio 4 Extra.